Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Twenty-one-year-old Denise Porch enjoyed her work. She was the resident manager for Yorktown Apartments, where she and her husband of 1 year lived. It was a busy job, constantly showing potential renters apartments and trying to make the sale, but she enjoyed the challenge. However, on the last day of July in 1975, it may have been one of her clients who was responsible for her disappearance. Last seen in the early afternoon, Denise was reported missing when her husband arrived home that night and found her gone. Investigators kicked off a massive search but couldn't find anything. No sign of violence, no indications of a crime, nothing. As one officer wrote in an official report, it was as if she vanished from the face of the earth. Over the next 46 years, investigators would work, first to find Denise, then to find the man who had likely killed her. The man multiple witnesses saw with her in the minutes before she vanished. 10 years later, investigators began to wonder if her disappearance was an isolated incident, or if it was tied to a series of disappearances and murders believed to be connected to a convicted killer. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 151, The Disappearance of Denise Porch. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the oldest unsolved missing persons case in North Carolina, the disappearance of Denise Porch. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 21-year-old Denise Porch had just celebrated her first wedding anniversary and was planning to build a family. Tragically, in a span of less than 15 minutes, she vanished without a trace, creating one of the longest enduring and most haunting mysteries in North Carolina history. This is Episode 151, The Disappearance of Denise Porch. The blazing summer sun slowly crept towards the horizon, though its impending setting did little to alleviate the sweltering heat, dropping just a few degrees from the low 80s to the high 70s. For 21-year-old Dean Porch, it had been a long week back to work, returning from a previous trip with his wife, Denise, where the two had celebrated their first year of marriage. Pulling into his space, right beside his wife's green Camaro, Dean stepped out of the car and made his way towards apartment number 3. Dean's keys jingled as he lifted them towards the lock, when his eyes caught sight of a note stuck to the door. It was from Denise. She was off showing an apartment to a potential renter, but would return soon. Dean sighed as he removed the note, just as the tumblers clicked and the door popped open. He'd been a little frustrated with Denise's job lately. It seemed like every time they sat down to dinner or turned on a show on TV, someone would come knocking, wanting to check out one of the vacant units. He tried to talk Denise into quitting, maybe finding a job with a set schedule, but she liked her job and figured with each apartment she managed to lease, there'd be less opportunities for interruptions. Stepping into the apartment, Dean was immediately hit with the cool wave rolling over him as the air conditioner hummed in the background, its blowing fans barely audible over the din droning from the television. Denise must not be planning to be gone long, Dean thought, since she wouldn't normally just leave everything on. Glancing towards the dining room table, Dean noticed Denise's purse lying there, and in that moment, he couldn't quite describe what came over him. It felt like worry, but not yet panic. A growing itch at the base of his neck that he just couldn't scratch. And that's when things began clicking into place. While Denise often showed apartments, it was part of her job as their complex's resident manager, she was always home before him. Curious and concerned, but unsure why, Dean found himself exiting the apartment, and moments later, he was knocking on the door of Pam Rigg, an assistant resident manager. Rigg had seen Denise hours earlier, in the process of taking a potential leaser to view an apartment, and then returning with the leaser 15 minutes later. In her mind, there was no reason to worry. Denise was always working, and she'd likely return soon. This didn't settle the matter for Dean, though, who then began stopping by the apartments of friends and acquaintances throughout the complex, wondering if they'd seen Denise. But no one had. In fact, no one had seen Denise in the hours since Rigg had. In a last-ditch effort, Dean made his way downstairs to the model apartment, which Denise used as an office, but found that location closed with the lights out. As his sinking suspicions slowly transformed from concern to fear to panic, Dean found himself racing back towards the apartment. Once inside, he grabbed the phone and dialed 911, and then spoke the words no one ever wishes to utter. "I think my wife is missing." Denise Annette Newsom was born on Thursday, March 25, 1954, to parents Emery and Joyce. Emery, a veteran of the Second World War, had met and married Joyce in England, with the couple arriving together in the United States in 1946. Over the course of the next 8 years, they would welcome 3 daughters, LaVon, Diane, and Denise, being the baby of the family. The 3 girls would grow up in the small town of Denton, located in Davidson County in central North Carolina. Denton, still a small town today, has doubled in size since the 1950s when Denise was growing up, at which time the population was just over 700. Denise's father, Emery, was the owner of a jewelry store in town, and over the years, several members of the family would work there. Growing up in Denton was, for the most part, the definition of small-town life, and according to those who knew her, Denise grew very accustomed to living in a place where everyone knew one another. As a youngster, Denise was noted for her sweet demeanor, shy nature, and blonde hair. While many children grow out of their shy phase, it seems to have hung around for Denise, as friends and family describe her as quiet and withdrawn around strangers. Joyce told the Robesonian newspaper that Denise was frequently complimented for being a very pretty young woman, and while she appreciated the sentiment, she wasn't exactly looking to draw attention. On at least one instance, in her youth, Joyce sought to enter her daughter into a beauty contest, and while Denise ultimately agreed, it had taken some convincing. Her sister, Diane, later recounted how Denise had loved playing with her dolls as a young girl, and later, going out to explore the wilderness around Denton. Denise was noted as being intelligent from a young age, frequently achieving straight A's throughout early school. Things didn't change much when she went on to attend Denton High School, as her name appears in several articles listing those who have made the dean's list. Interestingly enough, While Denise's interests were more rooted in her own hometown surroundings, it would be on a trip out of town that she'd meet the man who would change her life. In the summer of 1970, when she was 16, Denise met and fell in love with Rodney Dean Porch while vacationing in Myrtle Beach. From that time forward, despite the distance between their hometowns, their relationship would only grow stronger. Denise graduated from Denton High School in 1972, but her family was struck by tragedy that summer when her father, Emery, passed away on Monday, July 10th. According to his obituary, Emery arrived home Monday evening and suffered a massive heart attack. He was rushed to Rowan Memorial Hospital but was declared dead on arrival. The funeral was held at Clear Springs United Methodist Church, the Newsome Family Church, and Joyce was left as a widow, now taking over the family business at the jewelry store, as well as raising three girls. Denise pitched in, taking up shifts at the store while going on to attend Davidson County Community College, where she would obtain high grades and excellent marks. In the spring of 1974, she obtained her associate's degree, though this would not be the only major milestone in her life that year. On Sunday, July 14th, Denise and Dean were married in a 4 p.m. ceremony at Clear Springs United Methodist. Powell Newsom, her uncle, gave the bride away in the stead of his brother Emery, and she was attended to by her matron of honor, Gail Varner, a dear friend for whom Denise had been maid of honor just the year prior. According to the wedding announcement posted in the High Point Enterprise, following the ceremony, the couple honeymooned in Myrtle Beach, where they had first met, and then Denise would join Dean in Charlotte, where he lived while working for Standard Textile. According to Dean, the change from rural Denton to Charlotte wasn't an easy one for Denise, as he told the Charlotte Observer, quote, "She'd lived in Denton all her life. It terrifies her just living in Charlotte. She always says that when we start raising a family, we've got to move out of Charlotte." End quote. Denise disliked being alone in Charlotte to the point that on nights when Dean would be working late, she would go and stay with her mother-in-law in Belmont, some 15 miles out of town. Ultimately, Denise and Dean ended up moving into the Yorktown apartment complex, a stone's throw from their previous Flagstaff address, where in December of 74, Denise accepted work as an assistant resident manager. Throughout the early part of 75, she worked showing apartments to potential renters as well as assisting in the upkeep of the complex. She was eventually promoted out of her assistant position, becoming the resident manager, due in part to her hard work and success in signing up new leasers. While the promotion came with extra benefits, it also came with a higher workload, and for lack of a better term, Denise was essentially on call. The way the advertisements of the time promoted the complex, potential renters were directed to Denise and Dean's apartment, where they would just knock on the door and ask to see a unit. While Dean was happy to see his wife moving up the ladder, he also felt somewhat frustrated by the frequent intrusion of renters knocking on the door. He attempted to talk Denise into a different line of work, but she seemed happy with what she was doing and didn't think the interruptions were all that much of a hassle. Dean himself was also changing careers, having moved on from Standard Textile to insurance, where he was employed as a field agent by Liberty Life. In March of 75, both Denise and Dean would turn 21, the first of two large milestones that year. Just a few months later in July, the couple would celebrate their first wedding anniversary. Denise and Dean set off for the beach to mark the occasion, and according to friends and family, the couple couldn't have been happier. Upon returning from their trip, they attended a Three Dog Night concert at the former Charlotte Coliseum on the evening of Saturday, July 26th. Looking forward to another weekend concert, they purchased tickets to see Seals and Croft, who were playing at the same location on Saturday, August 2nd. The day after, the couple planned to drive out to Denton to visit Denise's family and pick up her two young nieces for a visit, according to the Charlotte Observer. But Denise would mysteriously vanish before that weekend could arrive. Thursday, July 31st, 1975 began like any other day. Dean and Denise woke in the morning and went about their daily routines. Take a shower, grab some breakfast, get dressed to go into the world. Despite my sincerest efforts, I've been unable to locate any source which provides an exact or even an approximate time that Dean left for work that morning. Being that he worked in the insurance field, the assumption's been made that he likely would have arrived to work between the hours of 8 and 9 a.m. So assuming that is the case, Dean heads off for work and won't return for 10 to 12 hours. As we know from Dean himself, sometimes he'd work overnight and Denise would go stay with his mother, so his hours were set, but days could easily run over. There isn't so much of an official timeline, so to speak, as there are variances in time estimates. Dean's account doesn't begin until approximately 8 p.m. Throughout the daytime hours, though, much of what we know is based on eyewitnesses who either saw or encountered Denise around the complex. In some instances, those times overlap, though none directly contradict one another. I've done my best to assemble the timeline based on all different accounts, though many people gave time ranges. So rather than seeing Denise at 2:30, someone would say they saw her between 2 and 3. It appears that Denise's comings and goings throughout that morning and early afternoon are unaccounted for, and the first time we become aware of her is at approximately 2 p.m. It was at this time that Denise was seen showing a model apartment to two men. The layout of the complex was such that there were multiple buildings spread out along the main road, and so when showing a potential leaser a unit, Denise would bring them to a model unit. Model units were made as replicas of actual apartments, so a potential leaser could see the space without the resident manager needing to take the client on a different apartment every time. This space also served as Denise's office. Denise, notoriously shy and cautious around strangers, would give clients two options. They could climb into the passenger seat of her 1973 green Camaro, and she would drive them to the model, or they could follow in their own vehicle. According to friends and family, she was adamant about not getting into a stranger's car. Sometime between 2:50 and 3:30, assistant resident manager Pamela Rigg was near the complex's swimming pool when she saw Denise drive by with an unknown man in her passenger seat, heading in the direction of the model unit. According to the Observer, Rigg saw Denise again 10 to 15 minutes later, driving back from the model unit. This time, Rigg and Denise locked eyes, and she smiled, waving as she passed by. As far as Rigg was concerned, there was nothing to indicate any issues at that time, and Denise was simply assisting a leaser. The man looking at the unit is believed to have been Mark Beaver, who later told police he was with Denise between 2:30 and 3 p.m. looking for an apartment. According to Beaver, while he and Denise were at the model, a man and a woman entered the building and asked about renting. Beaver told investigators he left the apartment complex at approximately 3 p.m. and noted that when he left, Denise was still talking to the man and woman. The man was described as being dark-haired. The last sighting of Denise took place at approximately 3:20 p.m. 27-year-old Yorktown apartment resident Ronnie Eubanks was late for an appointment and was rushing to get to his car. Eubanks' apartment was located near to Denise's, and according to his account, as he exited his apartment and moved towards the parking lot, he passed within 15 feet of Denise, who was speaking to an unidentified man. Interestingly, he noted that it appeared Denise and the man may have had some familiarity, as he told the Observer, quote, "It was just like she knew him or he had been there before," end quote. As Eubanks entered his vehicle and backed out of his space, he glanced towards Denise and noted that she was walking behind the man, following him, towards a dark green or blue compact car. The last thing Eubanks saw was the man opening the passenger side door and holding it as if he were waiting for Denise to climb in. This is the last confirmed sighting of Denise and the unknown man who was likely her abductor. A different man, seeking to rent an apartment, arrived at the complex at approximately 3:30, but got no answer when knocking on Denise's door. After waiting 20 minutes, he left, planning to return later. At approximately 4:45, he did return, and again knocked on Denise's door, but received no answer. Assuming she was showing someone an apartment at the time, he got back in his car and waited. When Denise didn't return by 6 p.m., the man simply drove off. This account, in combination with that of Ronnie Eubanks, will eventually allow investigators to narrow the window of time during which Denise disappeared to approximately 11 minutes between 3:20 and 3:31. Dean arrived home around 8 p.m., approximately 4.5 hours later. Upon entering the apartment, he discovered a note attached to the door, which Denise had left to tell him she was showing someone an apartment. That was fairly typical. However, Denise was rarely showing apartments after 7 p.m. Inside, the television and air conditioner were on, which suggested that Denise had planned to return quickly. Nothing in the apartment seemed out of place. Denise's purse was on the dining room table, and there was a bottle of nail polish sitting on the coffee table, as though Denise had been planning to do her nails or was in the middle of doing them when she was interrupted. Concerned about his wife, Dean went to the apartment of Pamela Rigg to ask if she had seen her. At this time, Rigg recounted her earlier brush with Denise when she was at the pool. Dean then visited several friends and acquaintances, though none had seen Denise that day. He also went by the model apartment and Denise's office, but found the lights off and doors locked. According to her mother, Joyce, she received a call from Dean just after 8 p.m. Not wanting to needlessly concern her, Dean apparently tried to conceal his worry and in a roundabout way asked if Joyce had spoken to her daughter that day. She hadn't, and when she asked Dean if anything was wrong, he told her no, everything was fine. Moments later, he called 911 to report his wife missing. When investigators arrived on the scene, they had little information or evidence to work with. According to official reports, there was no sign of a struggle nor any indication that anything violent had occurred within the apartment or anywhere in the complex. In total, between police officers and friends in the complex, 25 people were searching all around for any sign of Denise, though nothing was found. When speaking to Dean, investigators requested that he go through the apartment and make note of anything that might be missing. Reportedly, only 2 items that should have been there were gone: Denise's keys to the model apartment and a logbook in which she recorded the names and information of potential leasers who wanted to view the unit. At 11 p.m., Joyce called Dean to check in, at which time she learned that her daughter was officially missing. Initially, police weren't sure what they were dealing with, and considering the possibility that Denise might have run off on her own, but everyone in her life disagreed with that sentiment. Joyce told investigators that she was very close with her daughter, and they spoke by telephone at least every other day. When speaking to The Observer, Dean explained, quote, "She would never just leave, no matter what kind of pressure she was under. She just wasn't that kind of person," end quote. Multiple sweeps of the complex failed to turn up any trace of Denise. And as the sun began rising on the morning of Friday, August 1st, investigators widened their search parameters. According to W.J. Dunn, they moved on from the complex and began grid searches in several large fields in the surrounding area, but again, found nothing. It was around this time that Charlotte police issued a nationwide all-points bulletin broadcasting Denise's description, as well as making the note that they believed foul play was involved. Throughout much of the day on Friday, investigators went door to door in the complex, questioning residents about anything they might have seen the previous day, but leads were slow to develop. Frustrated and concerned for his wife, Dean reached out to the FBI and filed a missing persons report with them. While the case was not technically federal, the FBI offered its services to assist the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, namely in terms of tracking down any leads they might develop which cross state lines. Police, trying to determine what exactly had happened, questioned Dean again and asked several questions about Denise's job. Had she ever complained about a potential leaser making her uncomfortable or feeling threatened? Was there anyone at the complex or in Denise's life who she was leery of or tried to avoid? As far as has ever been reported, Denise never complained nor expressed any fear of anyone in particular outside of her general cautiousness around strangers. On Sunday, August 3rd, investigators were contacted by Ronnie Eubanks, the last person to see Denise alive. He'd been out of town and was unaware of the disappearance until he returned, at which time he immediately contacted investigators. It was at this time that Eubanks discussed seeing Denise walking behind the unknown man towards a dark blue or green compact car. Eubanks didn't get a good look at the unidentified man, as he explained to police he was in a hurry. However, when pressed, he described the man as being Caucasian, with a dark complexion and black hair. The man was dressed in casual attire, no jacket or tie, and was of slender build. While this wasn't enough to put together a composite drawing, it did give investigators a general sense of who they were looking for and what type of vehicle he may be driving. Police theorized that Denise may have either willingly got into the man's vehicle or perhaps was forced to do so with the suspect brandishing a weapon and making threats. When asked about this, Dean explained, quote, "Before she would get in a car with someone else, this person would have to gain her confidence," end quote. Knowing Denise's aversion to getting into anyone else's car, and given the description by Eubanks, police began to believe their early suspicion of foul play was likely going to be confirmed. Over the course of the next 2 days, police received multiple tips from across the state and even into South Carolina, and they began working to follow up. However, one particular call left them deeply concerned. A woman who has never been identified contacted police on Monday, August 4th. According to her, she was a passenger in a car traveling southbound on Interstate 77 in the vicinity of the Sleepy Hollow Road exit, just 1 mile to the west of the apartments. The witness noticed a woman who either fell or jumped from a moving vehicle. The woman then turned and began running northbound along the interstate while the car she had been pulled to the side of the road. At that time, a male exited the passenger seat and began pursuing her as she turned and ran across the median into the northbound lanes. According to the witness, a second man in the car began driving towards the woman and ultimately stopped, exiting to chase alongside the other. The witness described the driver as being a white male with a dark complexion and black hair just past his ears, approximately 25 to 30 years of age. She said the man had a slender build and was dressed casually, no jacket or tie. The vehicle was described as being a compact car, either navy blue or dark green. For investigators, this was an amazing lead, as both the description of the driver and the vehicle lined up closely with what they had learned from Ronnie Eubanks. However, they didn't want to leap to any conclusions without corroboration, and so they issued a statement in the media asking anyone who had been on I-77 in that area between 2:30 and 3:30 to contact them. Investigators launched a search of the area, both on foot and by air. Although they were not able to find any evidence to tie Denise to the scene, though it was considered possible it may have been an unrelated crime. On Tuesday, August 5th, the Charlotte News spoke with an investigator who requested that his name not be used. According to the anonymous officer, investigators had received 15 tips over the weekend and had managed to track down 6, but to no avail. One was related to a woman seen lingering around an apartment complex in Gastonia, though when police found her, she was described as a 42-year-old redhead who didn't remotely resemble Denise. Another tip led police to a dark-colored compact car, which had been abandoned near the town of Harrisburg, though when they located the owner, he explained the vehicle had simply broken down. The officer told the news that 5 investigators were working the case full-time, while several others were helping track down leads. It was noted that they had no evidence of foul play, and the case was technically still a missing persons investigation, but as the officer explained, quote, "We're putting a hell of a lot more into it than a normal missing persons case," end quote. In addition to investigators canvassing the apartment complex, reporters had showed up to interview residents. It was during one of these visits that a reporter from the Charlotte News spoke with a woman who had a concerning experience the afternoon Denise vanished. The woman, 25-year-old Gail Lucas, a neighbor of Denise and Dean, was directed to tell her story to investigators. According to Lucas, at approximately 2:30 p.m. Thursday, a man rang her doorbell, and when she answered, he replied that he must have come to the wrong apartment. For whatever reason, Lucas found the man's behavior strange, and she was unnerved by him and decided to keep an eye out. 15 minutes later, she saw the man again, this time walking towards the parking lot, where he entered a dark blue or green compact car. Instead of leaving, though, he simply sat there as if he was waiting for someone. Lucas described the man as being Caucasian, with dark eyes, standing approximately 6 feet tall, with a slender build, wearing a reddish-colored short-sleeved sports shirt. She stated that the man appeared neatly groomed and looked to be between the ages of 25 and 30. While this description mostly matched others given by Ronnie Eubanks and the unidentified passenger on I-77, it varied in one way. Lucas was certain the man she saw had a mustache, and this was a detail no other witness gave. When police followed up with Eubanks, he was clear that the man he saw did not have a mustache. He also stated that he didn't believe the man was 6 feet tall, which led investigators to wonder if they were describing the same man or perhaps two different men. In order to narrow the scope, two composite drawings were created, one showing the man with a mustache and one without. Those images were then brought to witnesses so they could point out any necessary changes. On Thursday, August 7th, the Charlotte Observer conducted a lengthy interview with Denise's mother. During that interview, Joyce pled with the abductor, saying he could have anything she owns if only he would return her daughter. Joyce, who had been sedated upon learning of her daughter's disappearance, was being supported by friends and family in Denton as she tried to grasp the horror of the situation. Desperate for the return of her youngest child, Joyce directed her words at the abductor, saying, quote, "Please release her. Let her go. As far as I'm concerned, release her and no questions asked," end quote. This same day, a reward totaling $2,000 was being offered for information leading to Denise's safe return. 65-year-old James McDonald, an employee at an Exxon gas station 2 miles to the northwest of the Yorktown apartments, called police to tell them about two men he'd encountered the day Denise disappeared. According to McDonald, at approximately 11:30 a.m. on Thursday, two men quickly drove into the station and came out of the car asking for directions to the apartment complex. The vehicle was described as being a dark blue or green compact car, and McDonald described both occupants as white males with dark hair just past the ears, appearing to be in their mid to late 20s, though he noted one had a darker complexion. While he believed both men had pronounced sideburns, neither had a mustache. Working with this information, police began trying to track down those two men and were ultimately contacted by one. According to that man, he and his friend had seen Denise that day as they were looking for an apartment. Both men were brought in for questioning and agreed to take polygraph tests, which they passed. Police eventually determined that these were likely the two men Denise had been seen with between 2 and 3. There was no evidence they were connected to her disappearance, nor did either man have any knowledge about it. They only became aware of a search for them when they read about it in the newspaper. Following questioning and the polygraphs, police verified their alibi for the time during which Denise had vanished, and both men were ruled out as suspects. While the field of potential suspects was narrowing, investigators were about to discover one potential suspect was not who they believed. 21-year-old Steve Caldwell sat down to read an article which featured the two artist composites, only to discover that he was one of the men police were searching for. Caldwell, an employee of the Charlotte Observer, told the paper he worked for that when he saw a picture of Gail Lucas, he recognized her as the woman whose apartment door he had accidentally knocked on. Caldwell went to the police seeking a detective to speak to, but was told none were available. It wouldn't be until the next morning that he was brought in question for approximately 30 minutes. According to Caldwell, he had gone to the apartments to visit a friend and coworker, Frank Pollock, and had knocked on Lucas's door by accident. After realizing his error, he found Pollock's door across the hall, and the two men hung out for a period of time. Police managed to verify Caldwell's alibi, and after photographing him for records, he was released. When asked about the description given by Lucas, Caldwell told the Observer she'd been fairly accurate for the most part, but several details were wrong. According to him, he did not have a mustache that day, and perhaps, most importantly, he had knocked on her door at approximately 5 p.m., not 2:30. Gail Lucas confirmed Caldwell was the man she had seen, though she was unsure how she had mistakenly given him a mustache. In response, Police noted they would continue using both versions of the composite sketch, as at least two other witnesses had acknowledged it resembled the man they saw. Lieutenant Wade Stroud, who was leading the investigation, explained, quote, "What it means is that there's somebody else who looks like this guy," end quote. When asked about the status of the investigation, Lieutenant Stroud told the Observer that leads were slowly drying up, and it seemed like the more they dug, the less they found. Investigators had been sent to Wadesboro, Belmont, Gastonia, and Chester, South Carolina to follow up on tips, though all had proven unhelpful. Stroud explained that they were in the process of re-interviewing anyone who knew Denise or Dean, as well as beginning production on flyers which would bear Denise's image, as well as those of the composite sketches, for statewide and possibly even national distribution. In terms of suspects, they'd spoken with a few people, but had been able to rule them out. And at the time, they were still searching for the dark-haired man with the dark complexion, though the case was proving difficult, as clues were in short supply. Time began passing more quickly, and investigators continued to hit dead ends in a case which had baffled them from the beginning. On August 31st, 1 month after Denise vanished, police were no closer to finding answers. It was their belief that Denise had likely been lured out of her apartment by someone posing as a renter, though the possibility existed that it could have been someone she had dealt with before, which could explain her potentially getting into his vehicle without the need to be threatened. As for the family, they were at a loss for how so much time could have passed with no new leads. Dean told the Observer that he called police daily, though there was never anything new to be told. When asked if he believed if his wife was still alive, Dean replied, quote, "As far as I can tell, from my inner self, she is alive. But each day that goes by is just much less the chance that she's alive," end quote. It was also noted at this time that the reward for information had increased to $6,500. On September 10th, police announced they had arrested a 51-year-old man named Edsel Howard Brown on extortion charges. Between August 8th and September 10th, members of Denise's family received 7 telephone calls and 4 letters from a man who promised he would safely return Denise in exchange for $50,000. Dean, when talking about one of the letters, stated, quote, "It said we were not to contact the police, that Denise was safe, and that we were to get the money together. It gave instructions on where we should go to leave the money, and it said a marker would be there. The letter also said, you'll get a call from Denise at 9 a.m. Wednesday morning telling you where she is, and you can come pick her up," end quote. Under the supervision of police, a family member went to the area, but the promised marker wasn't there. Police tapped the phones of family members and tracked the calls to a phone booth, which was then placed under surveillance. At 5:50 p.m. on September 10th, police and FBI agents apprehended Brown as he made his final call for ransom. Ultimately, police determined Brown was in no way connected to the abduction. He had given details about Denise and the crime during the ransom calls, but they'd all been incorrect. Brown pled guilty to charges of extortion and was sentenced to 10 years in prison in early November. His phone calls had been a local criminal matter, but when he sent letters through the postal service, he violated federal law, thus leading to a longer and harsher sentence. Brown had no connection to Denise or her family, and it was believed he chose to attempt to extort them after reading about the proposed reward money. By the end of 1975, investigators remained as perplexed by Denise's disappearance as they had been on day one. In January of 76, 6 months after Denise was abducted, Lieutenant Stroud spoke with the Observer and explained that they didn't have much to work with, saying, quote, "There hasn't been any suspect that we had the evidence to believe was a suspect. Everything we did was a shot in the dark. We didn't ever get a solid lead on it," end quote. When asked about the I-77 witness and the woman being chased, Stroud noted that they had dismissed the scenario. No other witnesses had been found, and the two other people in the car with their witness told investigators they didn't see anything. Despite the absence of evidence and clues, there was one person who drew interest from investigators, described in the Observer as, quote, a 34-year-old Charlotte man with kinky sex habits, end quote, though his name was not given. According to one investigator, the man was arrested in October of 75 for assault with a deadly weapon against a female he attempted to abduct at knife point. When digging into the man's life, they discovered he'd only worked a half day the afternoon Denise disappeared, and at the time was living just 300 yards from the Yorktown apartments. The man, who had a history of sexual violence towards women, owned property in South Carolina, and it was theorized he may have taken Denise there. However, when the man was given a polygraph, he passed without issue, and so he was ruled out, at least for a time. He will come up again in this case, but not for several years. Another lead was discovered when investigators went through Denise's belongings and found a business card connected to a man living in Amarillo, Texas. Local police were dispatched to question the man, who acknowledged he had met Denise and in fact had been at the apartment complex, but that had occurred on July 20th, 11 days before the abduction. Police were able to confirm his alibi for the time of Denise's disappearance and also noted that the man bore no resemblance to any of the witness descriptions. For investigators, they were eliminating potential suspects, but they simply couldn't discover any new ones. Lieutenant Stroud later told the Observer, quote, "I felt like we'd come up with something on this by now, but I was wrong," end quote. In February, it was announced that the state, under the encouragement of the SBI, was offering an additional $2,000 reward, making the total $8,500 for any information leading to the recovery of Denise Porch or the apprehension of her abductor. It was hoped that this increase would bring in more tips and also keep Denise's story in the headlines. In a bizarre twist of fate, Dean would find himself making headlines just a few weeks later. On February 29th, Dean was arrested and charged with assault with a firearm against two police officers. According to the Charlotte News, the officers were dispatched to the Yorktown apartment complex to check on a disturbance at 1:30 a.m. At that time, Dean emerged from his apartment and leveled a pistol at the officers. Whether or not Dean would be charged was debated in the prosecutor's office for several months before ultimately they chose to drop the charges, believing Dean was under considerable stress following the disappearance of his wife. Dean moved out of Charlotte the next month, going to Belmont to be near his family. 4 months later, Dean and Denise's families marked 1 year since she had disappeared. For Dean, it felt like his entire life was unraveling, and he turned his attention to God, hoping to be guided through the darkness, but there were no easy answers and no quick solutions. When speaking to the Observer, Dean explained, quote, "First I thought, it's been a whole day since she's been gone, then a whole month. Next, my God, it's been a whole year. At first I thought, why didn't this happen to me instead of her? But I have to accept things as they are and try to cope to the best of my ability. It's made me stronger spiritually as far as my church life and things like that are concerned. But it's made me weaker in the fact that I don't have the same enthusiasm for life I used to have. It takes a little bit of spark out of your life, knowing you're not going to have a wife waiting for you at home. No matter what they find, I'll still love her," end quote. In terms of the case itself, Lieutenant Stroud explained that it was still open, but they had no leads, and little progress had been made, but it was possible they'd solve it. It was all up in the air, as he said, quote, "Sometimes we clear them 2 or 3 years old. We might get some information this afternoon, or we might never," end quote. Stroud went on to state that they had exhausted every lead, gone over every clue, and still had found no trace of Denise. While hope and faith were waning across the board, Joyce refused to give up, saying, quote, "I will never give up hope until I know something different. I don't guess my life will ever be normal until I know the situation. I'll never stop wondering, hoping, and praying that something good will come out of it. I don't think anybody can know how you feel in this position unless they've experienced it. Not knowing is just about enough to drive anybody crazy," end quote. 6 more years would pass with no major developments. In February of 1982, nearly 7 years after Denise vanished, her family officially filed to have her declared legally dead. While they insisted this had not changed their belief that she could still be found alive, they acknowledged it would help them deal with certain legal matters, in particular relating to Denise's estate, which included several parcels of land inherited from her grandmother, as well as $10,000 split across multiple life insurance policies. 6 months later, in September, Judge William Helms granted the motion, and Denise was legally dead, with the language specifying that she had died at the hand or hands of a person or persons unknown. While this was a terrible ordeal for the family to endure, it was during this time that now Captain Stroud was interviewed and noted that they had a suspect in mind and had for the previous 2 years, but there wasn't enough evidence to charge him. That suspect, who remained unnamed, was serving time in a North Carolina jail and was in fact the same man with a history of violence against women who had previously been given a polygraph and passed. It wouldn't be until 3 years later in 1985 that police would identify him as Larry Jean Bell. On May 31st, 1985, 17-year-old Sharon Faye Smith disappeared while checking the mailbox at the end of her family's driveway. Her car was found next to the box, though there was no sign of her. Over the next few days, the Smith family received multiple phone calls from a man taunting them about their daughter's disappearance. He even forced Sharon to write out her own last will and testament, which he mailed to the family before providing them with directions to her remains in Saluda County, South Carolina. Just 2 weeks later, on June 14th, 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick was abducted from the front lawn of her family home in Richland County, just a few miles from the Smith home. After killing the child, the man again placed calls to the Smith family and eventually revealed the location of Deborah's remains in Lexington County. Both victims had apparently been killed via suffocation when he wrapped their heads in duct tape. On June 27th, police arrested Larry Jean Bell after tracking him down due to a partial phone number embedded in the paper of a letter he had sent. Bell was charged with kidnapping and murder in both cases, for which he would stand trial. Recordings made by police of calls Bell had made to the Smith family were admitted into evidence. During these calls, Bell described in disturbing detail what he had done to Sharon and how he had killed her. He gave very detailed directions to her remains, as he did in regard to Deborah. During 6 hours of testimony at trial, Bell shouted out bizarre phrases, such as wanting to marry Sharon's sister, while also proclaiming himself Jesus. Bell was found guilty on all charges and was given the death sentence, though he elected not to be put out by lethal injection and instead go through the electric chair. While the horrible murders of Sharon and Deborah had been solved, investigators began looking into Bell's life and wondering if he might be connected to other unsolved cases. They were specifically interested in the murder of Beth Marie Hagen and the disappearances of Sandy Elaine Cornett and Denise Annette Porch. Beth Marie Hagen, who was found to have been strangled with an electric cord, was found in the wooded area on December 18, 1980, when she was just 17 years old. The location of her body was near Mint Hill, North Carolina, not far from Alexander Road. At the time of her death, Larry Jean Bell lived at 221 Hickory Hill, approximately 2 miles to the south. Sandy Elaine Cornett disappeared from her home at 8918 Eagle Wind Drive on November 18, 1984. At that time, Bell was living at 8108 Will Hill Road, 5 miles to the northeast. Bell also knew Cornett. She was the fiance of one of his co-workers, and he'd attended a party at her home. Much like in Denise's case, there were no signs of a struggle, and she has never been located. On February 21st, 1975, Bell was arrested for assault and battery when he pulled a knife on a woman and attempted to abduct her. Luckily, the woman managed to escape, and while Bell faced a possibility of a long-term prison sentence, he was instead given 5 years probation after he agreed to seek treatment for his anger and violence. At the time, there was no law requiring his victim to be informed, and so she was not able to appear at his hearing or testify against him. She discovered he was out on probation secondhand. In July of 1975, Larry Bell lived at 5009 Cherry Crest Lane, approximately 300 yards from the Yorktown apartments. It was noted by Captain Stroud that within 2 weeks of Denise's disappearance, Bell moved away. In the case of Denise and Sandy, he lived in close proximity to the locations from which they disappeared. In relation to Beth, he lived close to where her body was found. Police theorized that in all three cases, Bell used either a knife or a gun to abduct the women. Unfortunately, investigators never had enough to prosecute Bell with any crimes connected to any of the three women. In regard to Denise, Bell never even acknowledged any connection to her, but that didn't stop investigators from believing he was responsible. As Captain Stroud explained, quote, "There is no doubt in my mind that he is the one that did it, but we don't have enough evidence to charge him," end quote. In October of 1975, just 3 months after Denise vanished, Bell assaulted a woman on the campus of the University of South Carolina, though she also managed to escape. Bell then checked himself into a mental health facility for 3 months, but was arrested and charged in June of 1976. At that time, his bail was revoked, and he was ultimately sentenced to 5 years in prison. However, he only went on to serve 21 months after again promising to seek treatment for his issues. One can't help but wonder how many people might be alive if only Bell had received the sentences he deserved, or if he'd actually been made to complete them. There are, of course, two other cases which over the years have been purported to possibly be connected to Denise's disappearance, and maybe to Larry Jean Bell. Sylvia Newman Gregory disappeared from the home she shared with her husband off Mallard Creek Road in April of 72. 18 months later, in January of 74, Sylvia's remains were discovered near Fort Mill, South Carolina, and it was determined that she had been murdered by a gunshot to the head. In the months following Denise's disappearance, investigators returned to this property to search, but never found anything. This potential connection was dismissed later when it was noted that police had a suspect in Sylvia's case and that he did not match the description of the man seen with Denise the day she vanished. In addition, evidence at the scene of Sylvia's abduction suggested a bloody and violent assault, while no evidence was found to show Denise had been taken through violent acts. Then there is Priscilla Blevins, who vanished on July 7th, 1975, just 3 weeks prior to Denise. Blevins was last seen at her apartment, located at 1700 Tivola Road, less than a mile from the Yorktown apartments. In 2012, familial DNA was used to confirm the identity of human remains discovered behind a guardrail on I-40 in Haywood County, approximately 2 hours from Charlotte near the Tennessee border in 1985. While it has been 9 years since Priscilla's remains were identified, there has been little new information on her case. Where it stands in regard to suspects, causes of death, and investigative resources is difficult to determine. In 1992, while Bell was on death row, a man came forward with a grisly story. According to this witness, he and a friend were hitchhiking in 1984 when they were picked up by Larry Jean Bell. The witness, a teenager at the time, claimed Bell took him and his friend to a well in Cherokee County, South Carolina, where he told them he had disposed of two bodies, one of which investigators believed might have been Sandy Cornett. Over the years, Bell made several references to Sandy, claiming that his evil twin suffocated her, that she had her fingers laced like she was praying, and that he wanted to talk to Charlotte investigators, though when he did, he talked mostly about the crimes for which he'd already been convicted. He apparently made several statements about the crime that only the killer would know, but not enough to give them anywhere to go with it. When police managed to find the well, however, excavation failed to reveal any human remains. Whether or not Bell had dumped bodies in the well, or even told the hitchhiker that story, has never been confirmed. Bell was scheduled for execution on October 4th, 1996. Previously extremely talkative, Bell grew quiet in the days leading up to his death. Multiple investigators attempted to speak with him about several unsolved crimes, namely Sandy's, but through his lawyer, he stated he didn't want to speak. While police were frustrated, they also felt it was unlikely they'd get much useful information from the man who had spent the better part of the past decade claiming to want to share details but never actually delivering much. Just after 1 a.m. on the 4th, Bell was executed via electrocution, and whatever secrets he may have possessed in regard to Denise, Sandy, or anyone else, he took with him. Sadly, just 7 months later, on May 12, 1997, Joyce Newsom passed away at the age of 74. For 22 years, she lived in the darkness of never knowing what became of her youngest daughter. While she worked hard to maintain hope that someday Denise would be found safe and alive, she also acknowledged the likelihood had shrunk over the decades. Over the years, she had been involved in raising awareness of the case, getting rewards increased, and had employed both private investigators and psychics, but to no avail. Her family hopes that, in passing, she has been reunited with her daughter that she lost so many years earlier. 2005 marked 30 years since Denise vanished, though the passing of 3 decades had done little to assuage the grief and pain. Denise's sister Diane now took up her mother's place as the main contact and force in the search for justice, the search for her little sister. When speaking to The Observer about the unknowing, Diane explained, quote, "It's a mystery. That's just what it is. I'd like to know who did it. I'd like to find her body. I'd like for someone to come forward. We try to just let this day pass. It's always in our minds and our hearts, but there's little we can do or say." End quote. For Dean, he mostly grew silent about Denise's disappearance after she was legally declared dead. It seems quite clear that the loss of his wife had a profound and detrimental effect on him as, over the years, he would face multiple charges from police related to drinking and driving, as well as domestic assault. Dean passed away on June 23, 2011, at the Bryan Center Health and Rehab Facility in Gastonia. He was 57 years old. Though he had tried to move on with his life, remarrying and having a child, he was never able to outrun the pain of losing Denise, and that drove him down a dark and dangerous path of alcoholism, which would often result in violent outbursts. As Dean himself put it, his life changed when Denise disappeared, and what joy he found began to wither. The last time Denise's name appears in the public record is in 2012, when Priscilla Blevins was identified. At that time, Diane spoke with The Observer about the possibility that someday she may get answers to her sister's case, just as the Blevins family had. Diane explained, quote, "I have accepted that she's not coming back, but you'd like to have something, some type of closure. I hope someday, just like the Blevins case, that will happen." End quote. When last seen, Denise Annette Newsom Porch was described as being a 21-year-old Caucasian female with blonde hair reaching to her mid-back and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing approximately 140 pounds. Denise was last seen wearing a blue and green print silk texture blouse and slacks. Denise was seen on Thursday, July 31, 1975, at the former Yorktown apartment complex off Tivola Road in Charlotte. According to witnesses, she was last seen in the presence of a man who was described as being Caucasian, with a dark complexion, dark hair past his ears, and dark eyes. He was dressed casually and was seen opening the passenger door to a dark blue or green compact car. While police believe Denise was likely murdered within hours of her abduction, if she were alive today, she would be turning 67 years old this month. This year will mark 46 years since she vanished that hot summer day. Most everyone who knew and loved Denise has come to accept the likelihood that she was killed by her abductor, though they hold out hope that someday her body may be found and she might be given a proper funeral and burial. Gail Varner was Denise's matron of honor, and the two were dear friends growing up together in Denton. When asked about her friend's disappearance all these years later, Gail replied, quote, "I wonder how she'd have been in later years, what her kids looked like, how she aged. I guess someday we'll know when we get to heaven." Have you ever wished you had a pocket-sized guide to help you sleep, focus, act, and be better? Well, thankfully, there is one. And if you have 10 minutes, Headspace can change your life. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations and an easy-to-use app. Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace can really help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation for you. Need some help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions their members swear by. And for parents, Headspace even has morning meditations you can do with your kids. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. My brain never stops, and it can be difficult for me to take the time I need to slow everything down. Thanks to Headspace, I don't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out the best approach or what exactly I'm supposed to be doing. I love how the infographics guide me along easily, and with session timers, I never lose out on a minute. Plus, with their email reminders, I never forget to take the time I need. All I have to do is tap the play button, and I'm off. Just 10 minutes later, and I'm ready to take the world on again. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/trace. That's headspace.com/trace for a free 1-month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/trace today.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
The disappearance of Denise Porch is the oldest unsolved missing persons case on file for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. 21 years old when she vanished nearly 46 years ago, and with few, if any, developments, most people don't believe it will ever be solved, that she will ever be found. During research for this episode, I found countless comments from longtime Charlotte residents noting how they remember her disappearing when they were teenagers, and now they're grandparents. It surely wasn't for any lack of trying. Police and the family poured everything they had into it. They just never got a break. They could never find that one piece that would complete the puzzle. For a long time, it was believed the case would warm up when her body was found. But all these years later, that's never happened. Or if it has, she is yet to be identified. When you're looking at a case where this much time has passed, you're looking at a high probability that even if Denise were to be found, the likelihood that her killer would be identified is limited, minus the possibility that he left behind some kind of evidence that would have endured nearly 5 decades of exposure. Then again, we've seen cases where people can be charged 20, 30, 40 years later when technology advances to that point and they can pull identifying information off even the most minute piece of evidence. Despite how it may seem, in the absence of evidence, one thing we know for sure is Denise did not just fall off the face of the earth. She was taken, and while there are countless places to conceal someone's remains, all things eventually rise to the surface. You'd imagine with a case this old, this heavily investigated, there'd be a lot of theories. Hell, you'd probably imagine there'd be a lot of coverage, and yet that isn't necessarily true. Denise's disappearance received a ton of coverage in the early days, but by 1977, mentions of her name and disappearance became few and far between. The last article written, the last major story compiled, came out nearly 9 years ago, and while she's been mentioned in documentaries about other cases, no one has really dug in deep. I suppose it's hard to keep discussing a case when the facts have remained the same the entire time. No physical evidence, no sightings, nothing. Ronnie Eubanks saw her at 3:20 p.m. on July 31st, 1975, and other than her abductor, no one has ever seen her again. When it comes to theories, there's really only two, although one of them is somewhat forked. By all logic, Denise was either abducted by someone she knew or targeted by a stranger, which is where I'll classify Larry Jean Bell when we get there. I wish there were more theories, I wish there was more to analyze, but in all reality, there was never any major evidence found or any new developments. Basically, from the moment Denise vanished, the search for her and her abductor was so devoid of anything to work with, it was difficult to determine just what might have happened. Based on witnesses, the common belief was that Denise was lured out of her apartment, either by someone posing as a potential leaser or by someone she may have known, even if only in a passing manner. So let's begin with the possibility that Denise could have known her abductor. We don't have a great deal of information. What we do have are statements of two witnesses who saw her the day she disappeared in the presence of a man both described similarly. Caucasian, dark complexion, dark hair, slender build, casual dress. According to one witness, the man drove a dark green or blue compact car, possibly a Maverick or Pinto or Volkswagen. Unfortunately, the vehicle description isn't that helpful. Just throughout the case, we've seen several people who didn't commit the crime driving similar cars, such as Steve Caldwell. In 1975, compact cars were not riding as high as they once had, but just 2 years earlier, they'd won the sales race, as many people were downsizing in response to the oil crisis, or embargo, which ran from October of 73 to March of 74. So, there were quite a few compact cars on the road at the time. However, I do think it's interesting to note that there's no report of Dean, Joyce, or anyone connected to Denise owning or knowing anyone who owned a compact car. I imagine that's something they would have looked into. I think for the most part, the concept that Denise may have known her abductor comes out of the statements from Eubanks, who said that when he saw her and the unknown man, they seemed to have some level of familiarity. Now, we don't know what that's based on, body language, behavior, tone of voice, but it was enough for him to pick it up. The question becomes, was this someone Denise knew like a friend, or just someone she had met in passing? Say, like someone who maybe had come to look at an apartment before, or possibly more than once in the previous months. Since Denise's logbook was missing, we have no way of knowing if the killer's name was on it, although there's a good chance that if he was on that list, he'd have used a fake name. Captain Stroud later said they'd managed to gather a list of people who had come by the apartments in the weeks leading up to the disappearance. I imagine that had to be filed with the owners in some way to show that Denise was doing her job. But how often that happened, I can't say. Weekly? Monthly? Quarterly? There's a chance the abductor's name was on a previous list, but again, it might not be a real name. We know Denise was shy around strangers, wouldn't get into their cars, and would make them come in her car or follow her. So while the theory follows the thought process that she was forced into the abductor's car by threat or with him brandishing a weapon, we also have the possibility that she might have felt comfortable with this person. If it was someone she'd shown an apartment to previously, she might not be hesitant. If it was someone she'd run into around town, at the store, or at social gatherings, that fear was unlikely to have been there. While we can't know exactly how Denise was behaving as she walked towards the abductor's car, it seems logical that had she looked scared, concerned, or out of sorts, Eubanks probably would have noticed. If he'd noticed that they seemed to know one another, it's unlikely he'd have missed something like that. I suppose the problem comes in when you look at the list of potential suspects. There's only ever really been two. Larry Jean Bell, and a 34-year-old Charlotte man defined as having a kinky sex habit, whatever that means in 1970s vernacular. I'd imagine something I consider fairly normal today would have been considered kinky in 1975, but I digress. Also, based on the fact that they say the 34-year-old Charlotte man had been arrested for attempting to abduct a woman at knife point in October of 75, sure sounds like they're talking about Larry Jean Bell, although he only would have been 26 at the time. So, surely it's possible Denise could have known her abductor in some way. It seems most likely if she did, it was casual at best, as she was clearly unaware of his dark side and the possibility that he could be dangerous. The problem is, there's never any connection established. There's no one in the complex who sees the guy and recognizes him. There's no one who sees his composite and says, oh, that looks like so-and-so. This implies whoever the man was, he wasn't someone who was around the apartment often, and if Denise did know him, apparently no one else in her life knew him well enough to recognize him by a composite. We know the mustache version was wrong, as it was based on Gail Lucas's account of seeing Steve Caldwell, even though he didn't have a mustache. As for the other version, Eubanks and Beaver surely thought it looked like the guy they'd seen. I've always found the detail interesting where Mark Beaver said the man showed up at the model apartment with a female companion. Now, I doubt this was a situation where the killer was working in tandem with anyone, but what if being there with that woman gave him the opportunity to return later without her and lure Denise out? Maybe she'd have felt more comfortable, especially if he said the woman was back at the model waiting for them. Don't worry about your keys, you can ride over with me. It's possible, especially if the woman had come by way of her own vehicle or had been dropped off somewhere. Unfortunately, there's not much more we can really do with this possibility other than acknowledge that it's there. I think, given what we know, it's more likely that any familiarity between Denise and her abductor was based on a casual acquaintance situation rather than someone she knew very well or was friends with. Dean himself said she would never have gotten into the car with someone unless they'd established some kind of trust, where she felt safe. Unfortunately, sometimes complete strangers can ingratiate themselves to us simply by returning, having a kind or polite demeanor, and reminding us that we've met them previously. Hell, if the guy had been stalking Denise and planning the crime rather than doing it spur of the moment, so to speak, he could have told her things that would make her believe they'd met, like saying he ran into her at the supermarket and telling her something she'd bought, or simply mentioning a place where she had been. At the end of the day, Denise knowing her abductor is a possibility, but there seems to be much more belief in the opposite, that the crime was random and perpetrated by someone Denise didn't know, and that leads us into the final section of the theories. In terms of a stranger abduction, there's a lot of possibilities there. While the area around the former Yorktown apartments has expanded tremendously in the years since, it was still a little booming area at that time. South Boulevard, from which you could get to the apartments, had a lot of traffic, and even Dean at one point said there was a chance someone driving on that road might have seen something. Interstate 77 was just a mile away. I-45 was less than 4 miles to the south. A lot of major interstate systems connect less than 10 miles to the north, near the Charlotte City Center. Even the South Carolina border was just 6 miles away. Tivola Square, just a block to the west, was built in 1969 and drew a lot of people to different stores that it offered. Basically, there's the possibility that a lot of different people could be passing through at any given time, and they didn't have to be local to Charlotte as long as they knew their way in and out. If one of those people had a proclivity towards abducting young women, it wouldn't take much to become aware of Denise. More than likely, there would have been some kind of information telling potential leasers to visit apartment 3 for information. Or maybe Denise's name could have been given on advertisements. Or it could have been as tragically simple as someone laying eyes on her and deciding that they wanted to target her. For whatever reason, I've always believed that whoever abducted Denise did not do so on a one-off, for lack of a better term. It always seemed like whoever did it did their homework and likely had come to view the model unit at least once before to get a feel for how things worked, who was around at what times, how far it was from Denise's apartment to the unit. They may have even watched the complex to note what times were busier than others, what days saw more potential leasers than others. I sincerely wish there was data available about how busy the days were, because choosing a Thursday instead of a Friday either means this guy knew whether or not Denise would be busy, or maybe it really was just spur of the moment. We can't really go through all the possibilities in terms of a stranger other than to say that there's a lot of them. The guy at the grocery store she shopped at, mail carrier, someone who just worked nearby and saw Denise from time to time, or perhaps someone who had done work for the apartments. A maintenance man, a repairman, for instance. Given how the crime was executed, leaving behind no clues by a man who, for the most part, went predominantly unnoticed outside of his skin tone and hair length, which was fairly common in 1975, it seems apparent this guy didn't really stand out. If you're looking for someone being described as being in his mid to late 20s, then more than likely, you're not looking at someone who had a ton of experience doing this sort of thing. That being the case, how did he manage to abduct Denise in what could be described as almost the perfect crime? Either he planned it out incredibly thoroughly, got very lucky, or he had done this before, at least a few times. That takes us to Larry Jean Bell. I think it's safe to say Larry Jean Bell's criminal history is fairly extensive, disturbing, and well-documented through books, documentaries, crime shows, and podcasts. All of that should suffice to give you whatever information you might want to find, so I hope you'll allow me to grant myself the ability to bypass digging too deeply into his sick and twisted acts so as to save myself the need to seek out a receptacle into which to vomit. In totality, Bell was charged, prosecuted, sentenced, and executed for the murders of Sharon Faye Smith, 17, and Deborah Mae Helmick, 9. While forensic evidence was compromised due to decomposition, based on Bell's own statements to the Smith family, it was clear he had sexually assaulted Sharon. Deborah, too, had been the victim of sexual assault. In both instances, it appears that the method by which they were killed involved the use of duct tape wrapped around their heads to cause suffocation. Bell, however, managed to leave no forensic evidence behind on either body and was ultimately captured due to a letter he wrote, which bore the imprint of a partial phone number, eventually tracked by the FBI, to the home of a couple he had been house-sitting for. The largest manhunt in the history of South Carolina was conducted looking for Bell, who beyond his crimes was also tormenting and taunting the Smith family in regard to their daughter's murder. Based on what we know of the crimes for which he was prosecuted, Bell's method of abduction was brazen but precisely executed. Sharon was taken at knife or gunpoint from her family driveway while picking up the mail. Deborah was abducted from her front lawn where she was in the presence of siblings and neighbors. Bell pulled over, exited his car, walked onto the lawn, grabbed Deborah around the waist, and ran back to the car. A neighbor witnessed the abduction, chased Bell, and managed to capture part of his license plate, but he was known to switch license plates. When famed profiler John Douglas was consulted on the abductions of Sharon and Deborah, he put together a profile which was remarkably accurate at the time. Douglas determined that Bell was an organized killer who planned out his crimes. He believed the man would be in his mid-20s to early 30s. Bell was 35. He also noted the abductor was likely previously married but now divorced, had served a short time in the military, was overweight, and had a knowledge of electronics. Bell, an electrician, was discharged from the Marine Corps shortly after joining when he shot himself in the leg while cleaning a weapon. He'd been married but divorced in 1976 and was overweight. Douglas further concluded that the killer would not stop with this crime and, in fact, had gotten off on the power and control he felt, both during the crime and while making his taunting phone calls. It was believed the killer craved attention and that the abduction of Deborah was, in part, a way to continue to garner that attention. While it was ultimately a mistake made by Bell that allowed him to be captured, if we look back at his previous history, it's clear to see that during the 70s, he was not nearly as adept. 10 years before his final arrest, on February 21, 1975, Bell approached a woman on Cherry Road in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and told her to come with him, but she refused. At that point, Bell produced a knife and held it to her abdomen while dragging her towards his green Volkswagen. The woman screamed and fought, and Bell fled, though he was captured by police not far from the scene. This was the first time he had been arrested. Bell pled guilty 3 months later in May of 75 and received a 5-year sentence, though that sentence was suspended after he paid a fine and promised to receive treatments for his violent tendencies. He attended one session. If indeed Bell was responsible for Denise's disappearance, this would mean that, while on probation and less than 70 days after he'd left court, he targeted Denise, pulled off her abduction without leaving behind any evidence, and managed to, for the time, get away with his crime. That's quite a difference between grabbing a woman in a public area and trying to drag her to a car with a knife versus actually being able to abduct Denise without causing a scene and without being caught. Now, you might say that he learned from that first attempt. However, Just 2 months later, in October, he approached a woman on the campus of the University of South Carolina in Columbia and brandished a handgun, telling her that he was armed and to get into his car. Again, a struggle ensued, and the woman managed to escape. Bell was captured 8 months later in June of 76 and pled guilty to assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature. Bell's probation was revoked, and he was sentenced to 5 years, though he would only serve 21 months. During this stint, Bell received psychiatric care and was diagnosed as having a personality disorder which connected to sexual acts and violence, and doctors noted he would attack again. 3 years later, in October of 1979, Bell was arrested for making a series of obscene phone calls to a 10-year-old girl in Charlotte. The calls had run from February to July, and when arrested, he once again pled guilty. This time, he was sentenced to a 2-year suspended sentence and 5 years probation. I know what you're thinking, because I'm thinking it too. Maybe if this asshole had actually been jailed for his crimes for longer than it takes to obtain an associate's degree, there might be a few less dead women and children out there. I don't want to get sidetracked, but just for a moment, consider this. If he had served even half of the 5 years he could have gotten in May of 75, he'd have been in prison until the beginning of 78, which means no attack on the woman at USC and no possible involvement in the disappearances of Denise Porch or Priscilla Blevins. If he then committed the obscene calls in 79 and was given 2 years instead of 2 years suspended, he wouldn't be considered a suspect in the murder of Beth Marie Hagen, who was killed in 1980. So I don't know. What do you think? Does it sound like on July 31st, 1975, Bell had gotten to a level where he'd be considered an organized killer who planned out his attacks as he was later profiled? Or was he more likely still not there yet, making a successful abduction of Denise Porch a miraculous stroke of luck? There's two possibilities I consider here. Either Bell partially knew Denise in passing. He did live just 300 yards away and could function as an electrician, which may have been needed at the complex from time to time. Or maybe the other two women managed to escape because when Bell pulled a weapon, they fought and caused a scene where Denise perhaps cooperated, or if she did cause a scene, no one noticed. It's just hard for me to accept that he fails at his first attempt, or at least what's documented as his first attempt, succeeds with flying colors on his second attempt, third, if you believe he was responsible for Blevins, and then fails in nearly the same fashion as his first attempt when he attacks the woman 2 months later at USC. I think if the profile was based purely on Bell's abduction and murder of Sharon, then organized might make sense. But given his history, even if you discount what is only alleged, he probably falls more into the category of a mixed killer, as he clearly exhibits behavior from both organized and disorganized categories. His abduction of Sharon may have been well planned for something that seems almost impulsive. We know he scripted the phone calls he made and disguised his voice, showing intelligence and forethought. However, Deborah's abduction seems more impulsive by comparison. When you look at his failed attempts and the crimes he suspected of, you can see some being well planned, others being poorly executed. I imagine you'd also have to factor in other circumstances or stressors that could have been impacting his actions. He got divorced in 1976, so maybe in the summer of 75 he was more off kilter than usual. There's also the question of mental illness, though that's been hotly debated. During his arrest and trial, he was prone to outbursts and claims that he was God, Jesus, or that he had powers. While the defense argued he had a clear-cut diagnosis of schizophrenia, the prosecution argued it was all an act to try and get himself declared incompetent to stand trial or perhaps to avoid execution. I'm not a diagnostician, but clearly there was mental illness there. It just becomes a question of whether that would influence his crimes and his tendency to do them, or if he was fully aware of what he was doing. My money is on the latter. More than likely, Bell had assaulted women prior to his first arrest, beyond female family members that we know he molested in his youth. How many, we can't be sure, and whether or not those victims survived those attacks or were killed is something we may never know. If he was indeed involved in the disappearance and likely murders of Priscilla Blevins and Denise Porch, then we know that by the age of 26, Bell had already committed 2 murders and attempted to abduct 2 other women. In 1984, Sandy Cornett goes missing from her home. Belle knows Sandy. She's engaged to one of his coworkers, and he's been to her home for an event previously, so he knows the location, which also happens to be in close proximity to where he's living at the time. In this case, Sandy's never found, and while Belle mentioned her name to investigators and said things that seemed to suggest he knew a lot more about the crime than someone should, he never really gave any information about what happened or where she might be. So to summarize, Belle attempts to abduct a woman and fails. A few months later, he possibly succeeds at abducting and murdering Denise Porch and or Priscilla Blevins. Blevins' remains are found next to a guardrail near the Tennessee border 10 years later. Denise has never been located. He attempts to abduct a woman from USC and fails, serving a little less than 2 years. He makes obscene phone calls to a 10-year-old girl and receives a suspended sentence. He's then presumed to have murdered Beth Marie Hagen, and rather than causing her to never be found, he leaves her body in the woods not far from his own home. He then abducts and murders Sandy Cornett and this time disposes of her remains in a way in which she's never been located. Then he abducts and murders Sharon Smith and within days gives directions to her remains. Then he abducts and kills Deborah Helmick and again details where the body can be found. He makes taunting phone calls. He sends letters. He forces Sharon to write out her own will. So we know Belle killed Sharon and Deborah. We know he's the prime suspect in the murder of Sandy Cornett. And we know he's the only suspect in the disappearance of Denise Porch. In some cases, he leaves the bodies. In others, he conceals them, while in others still, he tells people how to find them. Sharon and Deborah are suffocated. Beth is strangled. Denise, Priscilla, and Sandy's causes of death are unknown. He has a tendency to strike close to where he lives, and in July of 75, he's staying right near the Yorktown apartments from which Denise vanishes, very close to where Priscilla vanished. He also, in 1975, drives a green Volkswagen, and while it's never directly stated what model, it's unlikely to have been a bug since nobody calls it that. This means it was likely either a Rabbit or a Scirocco, both of which are compact cars available in dark green and dark blue. So, I suppose all we can really do is look at what we know. Does Larry Jean Belle fit the description given by witnesses? It's been difficult to locate photos of what he looked like in the 70s, but given what other photos we do have, he surely has dark hair, and even in the 80s it was touching his ears. His complexion isn't exactly what I would call dark, though perhaps he could have had a tan at the time. It was a hot summer. According to his mugshot and multiple descriptions, he's 5 feet 9 inches tall, which would fit Eubanks, since he didn't think the abductor was over 6 feet. We know he was living just 300 yards from the complex at the time, and based on his first failed abduction attempt in February, he was driving a green Volkswagen. He always seemed to live near where someone disappeared or where their remains were found, so that would fit. So yes, we can put Belle in the area. Denise disappears between two failed abduction attempts and just 3 weeks after Priscilla. Physically, there are similarities, and it's always important to keep in mind that typically eyewitness descriptions are rather inaccurate, especially when they only have a quick look. He surely would have had the means and opportunity given his history, and I'm not sure that he required much of a motive. I suppose it just becomes a question of likelihood. Given what we know, he seems to be the most likely suspect, but that doesn't necessarily mean it couldn't have been someone else. In the end, it depends on what you believe is connected. What disappearances and murders Belle committed? All that he was accused of? Just some? To me, it's always seemed like there's a link between Denise and Priscilla, but what throws me off is Priscilla being found near the Tennessee border. Belle was more likely to go into South Carolina than several hours to the west, to Tennessee, but he was also in his early stages. So what do you think? Does it just fit so perfectly that it's Larry Jean Belle all the way? Or is it possible someone else was abducting and murdering women in the Charlotte area around the same time? Could Denise have known her abductor? Or was it truly someone posing as a potential renter? Or maybe someone who actually was looking to rent and developed an infatuation? From what I've seen, the vast majority, including law enforcement, believe Denise was a victim of Larry Jean Belle. I wouldn't have a problem accepting that as the most likely scenario. But if someone else was in the area, fit the description, and committed similar crimes, it wouldn't be difficult to sway my opinion based on what facts were present. In some ways, I believe Bell is responsible. In others, I could see it being a matter of him being the only potential suspect that was ever brought up, and perhaps that could lead to a sort of tunnel vision. Tragically, we may never discover the truth of what became of Denise Porch, and in just 4 years, it will have been 50 years since she was last seen. In all likelihood, as investigators believed, her life was taken within hours of her disappearance, and her remains are concealed somewhere between the borders of Tennessee, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Extensive searches of property owned by Bell and near to him were conducted looking for both Denise and Sandy, but nothing was ever found. Of course, if Bell decided they shouldn't be found, they could be almost anywhere. Hopefully, someday, they will be found. While it wouldn't remove the pain of loss, Denise's family would very much like to give her a proper funeral and lay her to rest. As far as catching the killer, some people believe they already have. For others, they need something more definitive. Unfortunately, without new evidence, the discovery of Denise's remains or a confession from someone other than Bell, the disappearance of Denise Porch will remain open and unsolved.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Denise Porch, there are many news articles available, with the Charlotte Observer being the most extensive. There are many documentaries, podcasts, and crime shows that discuss Larry Jean Bell, and Denise is often mentioned in them. The book, Murder in the Midlands, Larry Jean Bell and the 28 Days of Terror That Shook South Carolina, by Rita Schuler, digs deep into all the details surrounding the 1985 manhunt and peripheral cases. If you have any information about the disappearance of Denise Porch, please contact the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police at 704-336-2311. You can also submit information anonymously through Crime Stoppers at 704-334-1600. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Vox Nihili. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. I appreciate you listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Thank you. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.